It's not important to the boys, and we're supposed to cook for you? He couldn't entirely blame Caroline. In the years when she'd worked full-time, he'd never complained about frozen or take-out or pre-prepared dinners. To Caroline it probably seemed that he was changing the rules on her, but to Gary it seemed that the nature of family life itself was changing, that togetherness and filiality and fraternity weren't valued the way they were when he was young. And so, here he was, still grilling. Through the kitchen windows he could see Caroline thumb-wrestling Jonah. He could see her taking Aaron's headphones to listen to music, could see her nodding to the beat. It sure looked like family life. Was there really anything amiss here but the clinical depression of the man peering in? Caroline seemed to have forgotten how much her back hurt, but she remembered as soon as he went inside with the steaming, smoking platter of vulcanized animal protein. She seated herself sideways at the table, nudged her food with a fork, and whimpered softly. Caleb and Aaron regarded her with grave concern.
"Doesn't anyone else want to know how Prince Caspian ends?" Jonah said. "Isn't anyone curious at all?"
Caroline's eyelids were fluttering, her mouth hanging open miserably to let air trickle in and out. Gary struggled to think of something undepressed to say, something reasonably unhostile, but he was rather drunk. "Jesus, Caroline," he said, "we know your back hurts. We know you're miserable, but if you can't even sit up straight at the table..." Without a word, she slid off her chair, hobbled to the sink with her plate, scraped her dinner into the garbage grinder, and hobbled upstairs. Caleb and Aaron excused themselves and ground up their own dinners and followed her. Altogether, maybe $30 worth of meat went into the sewer. But Gary, trying to keep his factor 3 levels off the floor, succeeded pretty well in forgetting about the animals that had died for this purpose. He sat in the leaden twilight of his buzz, ate without tasting, and listened to Jonah's impervious, bright chatter.
"This is an excellent skirt steak, Dad, and I would love another piece of that grilled zucchini, please."
From the entertainment room upstairs came the woofing of prime time. Gary felt briefly sorry for Aaron and Caleb. It was a burden to have a mother need you so extremely, to be responsible for her bliss. Gary knew this. He also understood that Caroline was more alone in the world than he was. Her father had been a handsome, charismatic anthropologist who died in a plane crash in Mali when she was 11. Her father's parents, old Quakers who intermittently said thee, had left her half of their estate, including a well-regarded Andrew Wyeth, 3 Winslow Homer watercolors, and 40 sylvan acres near Kennett Square, for which a developer had paid an incredible sum. Caroline's mother, now 76 and in scarily good health, lived with her second husband in Laguna Beach and was a major benefactor of the California Democratic Party. She came east every April and bragged about not being one of those old women who were obsessed with their grandkids. Caroline's only sibling, a brother named Philip, was a patronizing, pocket-protected bachelor and solid-state physicist on whom her mother doted somewhat creepily. Gary hadn't known this kind of family in St. Jude. From the start, he'd loved and pitied Caroline for the misfortune and neglect she'd suffered growing up. He'd undertaken to provide a better family for her. But after dinner, while he and Jonah were loading the dishwasher, he began to hear female laughter upstairs, actual loud laughter. And he decided that Caroline was doing something very bad to him. He was tempted to go up and crash the party. As the buzzing of the gin faded from his head, however, the clanging of an earlier anxiety was becoming audible, an Exxon-related anxiety. He wondered why a small company with a highly experimental process was bothering to offer his father money. That the letter to Alfred had come from Bragg, Neuter & Spey, a firm that often worked closely with investment bankers, suggested due diligence, a dotting of I's and crossing of T's on the eve of something big. "Do you want to go and be with your brothers?" Gary said to Jonah. "It sounds like fun up there."
"No, thank you," Jonah said. I'm going to read the next Narnia book, and I thought I might go to the basement where it's quiet. Will you come with me?
The old playroom in the basement. Still dehumidified and carpeted and pine-paneled, still nice, was afflicted with the necrosis of clutter that sooner or later kills a living space. Stereo boxes, geometric styrofoam packing solids, outdated ski and beach gear in random drifts. Aaron and Caleb's old toys were in 5 big bins and 12 smaller bins. Nobody but Jonah ever touched them. And in the face of such a glut, even Jonah, alone or with a playdate pal, took an essentially archaeological approach. He might devote an afternoon to unpacking half of one large bin, patiently sorting action figures and related props, vehicles, and model buildings by scale and manufacturer, toys that matched nothing he flung behind the sofa. But he rarely reached the bottom of even one bin before his playdate ended, or dinner was served, and he reburied everything he'd excavated. And so the toys, whose profusion ought to have been a 7-year-old's heaven, went basically unplayed with. Another lesson in anhedonia for Gary to ignore as well as he could. While Jonah settled down to read, Gary booted up Caleb's old laptop and went online. He typed the words Axon and Schwenksville in the search field. One of the 2 resulting site matches was the Axon Corporation homepage, but this site, when Gary tried to reach it, turned out to be under renovation. The other match led him to a deeply nested page in the website of West Portfolio Biofunds, whose listing of privately held corporations to watch was a cyber backwater of drab graphics and misspellings. The Axon page had last been updated 1 year earlier.
Axon Corporation, 24 East Industrial Serpentine, Schwenksville, Pennsylvania, a limited liability corporation registered in the state of Delaware, holds worldwide rights to the Eberle process of directed neurochemotaxis. The Eberle process is protected by United States patents 5,101,239, 5,101,599, 5,103,628, 5,103,629, and 5,105,996, for which the Axon Corporation is the sole and exclusive grantor of license. Axon engages in refinement, marketing, and sales of the Eberle process to hospitals and clinics worldwide and in research and development of related technologies. Its founder and chairman is Dr. Earl H. Eberle, former distinguished lecturer in applied neurobiology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. The Eberle process of directed neurochemotaxis, also known as Eberle reverse tomographic chemotherapy, have revolutionized the treatment of inoperable neuroblastomas and a variety of other morphologic defects of the brain. The Eberle process utilizes computer-orchestrated RF radiation to direct powerful carcinicides, mutagens, and certain nonspecific toxins to diseased cerebral tissues and locally activate them without harm to surrounding healthy tissue. At present, due to limitations in computing power, the Eberle process requires sedating and immobilizing the patient in an Eberle cylinder for up to 36 hours, while minutely orchestrated fields direct therapeutically active ligands and their inert piggyback carriers to the site of disease. The next generation of Eberle cylinders is expected to reduce maximum total treatment time to less than 2 hours. The Eberle process received full FDA approval as a safe and effective therapy in October 1996. Widespread clinical use throughout the world in the years since then, as detailed in the numerous publications listed below, have only confirmed its safety and effectiveness. Gary's hopes of extracting quick megabucks from Axon were withering in the absence of online hype. Feeling a bit e-weary, fighting an e-headache, he ran a word search for Earl Eberle. The several hundred matches included articles with titles like New Hope for Neuroblastoma and A Giant Leap Forward and This Cure Really May Be a Miracle. Eberle and collaborators were also represented in professional journals with remote computer-aided stimulation of receptor sites 14, 16A, and 21, a practical demonstration. Four low-toxicity ferroacetate complexes that cross the BBB. In vitro RF stimulation of colloidal microtubules, and a dozen other papers. The reference that most interested Gary, however, had appeared in Forbes ASAP 6 months earlier. Some of these developments, such as the Fogarty balloon catheter and LASIK corneal surgery, are cash cows for their respective corporate patent holders. Others, with esoteric names like the Eberle process of directed neurochemotaxis, enrich their inventors the old-fashioned way, one man, one fortune. The Eberle process, which as late as 1996 lacked regulatory approval, but today is recognized as the gold standard for the treatment of a large class of cerebral tumors and lesions, is estimated to net its inventor, Johns Hopkins neurobiologist Earl H. Curly Eberle, as much as $40 million annually in licensing fees and other revenues worldwide. $40 million annually was more like it. $40 million annually restored Gary's hopes and pissed him off all over again. Earl Eberle earned $40 million annually, while Alfred Lambert, also an inventor, but let's face it, a loser by temperament, one of the meek of the earth, was offered $5,000 for his trouble, and planned to split this pea with Orphic Midland. "I'm loving this book," Jonah reported. "This may be my favorite book yet." So why, Gary wondered, why the rush to get Dad's patent, eh, Curly? Why the big push? Financial intuition, a warm tingling in his loins, told him that perhaps, after all, a piece of inside information had fallen into his lap. A piece of inside information from an accidental and therefore perfectly lawful source. A juicy piece of private meat. "It's like they're on a luxury cruise," Jonah said, "except they're trying to sail to the end of the world. See, that's where Aslan lives, at the end of the world." In the SEC's Edgar database, Gary found an unapproved prospectus. A so-called red herring prospectus for an initial public offering of Axon stock. The offering was scheduled for December 15th, 3+ months away. The lead underwriter was Heavy and Hodap, one of the elite investment banks. Gary checked certain vital signs, cash flow, size of issue, size of float, and, loins tingling, hit the download later button. "Jonah, 9 o'clock, he said. "Run up and take your bath."
"I would love to go on a luxury cruise, Dad," Jonah said, climbing the stairs, "if that could ever be arranged."
In a different search field, his hands a little Parkinsonian, Gary entered the words beautiful, nude, and blonde. "Shut the door, please, Jonah." On the screen, an image of a beautiful nude blonde appeared. Gary pointed and clicked, and a nude tan man, photographed mainly from the rear, but also in close-up from his knees to his navel, could be seen giving his fully tumid attention to the beautiful nude blonde. There was something of the assembly line in these images. The beautiful nude blonde was like fresh raw material that the nude tan man was extremely keen to process with his tool. First, the material's colorful fabric casing was removed, then the material was placed on its knees, and the semi-skilled worker fitted his tool into its mouth, then the material was placed on its back while the worker orally calibrated it, then the worker clamped the material into a series of horizontal and vertical positions, crimping and bending the material as necessary, and very vigorously processed it with his tool. The pictures were softening rather than hardening Gary. He wondered if he'd reached the age where money excited him more than a beautiful nude blonde engaging in sex acts, or whether anhedonia, the solitary father's depression in a basement, might be encroaching even here. Upstairs the doorbell rang. Adolescent feet came pounding down from the second floor to answer it. Gary hastily cleansed the computer screen and went upstairs in time to see Caleb returning to the second floor with a large pizza box. Gary followed him and stood for a moment outside the entertainment room, smelling pepperoni and listening to the wordless munching of his sons and wife. On TV, something military, a tank or a truck, was roaring to the accompaniment of war movie music.
"They increase the pressure, Lieutenant. Now you will talk. Now?"
In hands-off parenting, skills for the next millennium, Dr. Harriet L. Shachtman warned, "All too often today's anxious parents protect their children from the so-called ravages of TV and computer games, only to expose them to the far more damaging ravages of social ostracization by their peers." To Gary, who as a boy had been allowed half an hour of TV a day and had not felt ostracized, Shachtman's theory seemed a recipe for letting a community's most permissive parents set standards that other parents were forced to lower their own to meet. But Caroline subscribed to the theory wholeheartedly. And since she was the sole trustee of Gary's ambition not to be like his father, and since she believed that kids learned more from peer interaction than from parental instruction, Gary deferred to her judgment and let the boys watch nearly unlimited TV. What he hadn't foreseen was that he himself would be the ostracized. He retreated to his study and dialed St. Jude again. The kitchen cordless was still on his desk, a reminder of earlier unpleasantness and a fight still to come. He was hoping to speak to Enid, but Alfred answered the telephone and said that she was over at the Roots house, socializing.
"We had a street association meeting tonight," he said.
Gary considered calling back later, but he refused to be cowed by his father.
"Dad," he said, "I've done some research on Axon. We're looking at a company with a lot of money."
"Gary, I said I didn't want you monkeying with this," Alfred replied. "It is moot now, anyway."
"What do you mean, moot?"
"I mean moot. It's taken care of. The documents are notarized. I'm recouping my lawyer's fees, and that's the end of it."
Gary pressed two fingers into his forehead. "My God, Dad, you had it notarized? On a Sunday?"
"I will tell your mother that you called. Do not put those documents in the mail, do you hear me? Gary, I've had about enough of this."
"Well, too bad, because I'm just getting started. I've asked you not to speak of it. If you will not behave like a decent, civilized person, then I have no choice. Your decency is bullshit. Your civilization is bullshit. It's weakness. It's fear. It's bullshit. I have no wish to discuss this."
"Then forget it." "I intend to. We'll not speak of it again. Your mother and I will visit for 2 days next month, and we will hope to see you here in December. It's my wish that we can all be civil."
"Never mind what's going on underneath, as long as we're all civil. That is the essence of my philosophy, yes."
"Well, it ain't mine," Gary said. "I'm aware of that, and that's why we will spend 48 hours and no more."
Gary hung up angrier than ever. He'd hoped his parents would stay for an entire week in October. He'd wanted them to eat pie in Lancaster County, see a production at the Annenberg Center, drive in the Poconos, pick apples in Westchester, hear Aaron play the trumpet, watch Caleb play soccer, take delight in Jonah's company, and generally see how good Gary's life was, how worthy of their admiration and respect. And 48 hours was not enough time. He left his study and kissed Jonah goodnight. Then he took a shower and lay down on the big oaken bed and tried to interest himself in the latest ink. But he couldn't stop arguing with Alfred in his head. During his visit home in March, he'd been appalled by how much his father had deteriorated in the few weeks since Christmas. Alfred seemed forever on the verge of derailing as he lurched down hallways or half-slid downstairs or wolfed at a sandwich from which lettuce and meatloaf rained. Checking his watch incessantly, his eyes wandering whenever a conversation didn't engage him directly, the old iron horse was careering toward a crash. And Gary could hardly stand to look. But who else, if not Gary, was going to take responsibility? Enid was hysterical and moralizing, Denise lived in fantasy land, and Chip hadn't been to St. Jude in 3 years. Who else but Gary was going to say, "This train should not be running on these tracks"? The first order of business, as Gary saw it, was to sell the house. Get top dollar for it, move his parents into someplace smaller, newer, safer, cheaper, and invest the difference aggressively.
The house was Enid and Alfred's only large asset, and Gary took a morning to inspect the whole property slowly, inside and out. He found cracks in the grouting, rust lines in the bathroom sinks, and a softness in the master bedroom ceiling. He noticed rain stains on the inner wall of the back porch, a beard of dried suds on the chin of the old dishwasher, an alarming thump in the forced air blower, pustules and ridges in the driveway's asphalt, termites in the woodpile, a Damoclean oak limb dangling above a dormer, finger-wide cracks in the foundation, retaining walls that listed, white caps of peeling paint on window jams, big emboldened spiders in the basement, fields of dried sow bug and cricket husks, unfamiliar fungal and enteric smells everywhere he looked, the sag of entropy. Even in a rising market, the house was beginning to lose value, and Gary thought, we've got to sell this fucker now. We can't lose another day. On the last morning of his visit, while Jonah helped Enid bake a birthday cake, Gary took Alfred to the hardware store. As soon as they were on the road, Gary said it was time to put the house on the market. Alfred, in the passenger seat of the Gerontic Olds, stared straight ahead. Why? If you miss the spring season, Gary said, you'll have to wait another year. And you can't afford another year. You can't count on good health, and the house is losing value. Alfred shook his head. I've agitated for a long time. One bedroom and a kitchen is all we need. Somewhere your mother can cook and we have a place to sit. But it's no use. She doesn't want to leave. Dad, if you don't put yourself someplace manageable, you're going to hurt yourself. You're going to wind up in a nursing home.
I have no intention of going to a nursing home.
So? Just because you don't intend to doesn't mean it won't happen. Alfred looked, in passing, at Gary's old elementary school.
Where are we going?
You fall down the stairs, you slip on the ice and break your hip, you're going to end up in a nursing home. Caroline's grandmother...
I didn't hear where we were going.
We're going to the hardware store, Gary said. Mom wants a dimmer switch for the kitchen. Alfred shook his head.
She and her romantic lighting.
She gets pleasure from it, Gary said. What do you get pleasure from?
What do you mean?
I mean, you've just about worn her out. Alfred's active hands, on his lap, were gathering nothing, raking in a poker pot that did not exist.
I'll ask you again not to meddle, he said.
The mid-morning light of a late winter thaw, the stillness of a weekday non-hour in St. Jude, Gary wondered how his parents stood it. The oak trees were the same oily black as the crows perching in them. The sky was the same color as the salt-white pavement on which elderly St. Judean drivers obeying barbiturate speed limits were crawling to their destinations, to malls with pools of meltwater on their papered roofs, to the arterial that overlooked puddled steel yards and the state mental hospital and transmission towers feeding soaps and game shows to the ether, to the beltways and beyond them to a million acres of thawing hinterland where pickups were axle-deep in clay, and 22s were fired in the woods and only gospel and pedal steel guitars were on the radio, to residential blocks with the same pallid glare in every window, besquirreled yellow lawns with a random plastic toy or two embedded in the dirt, a mailman whistling something Celtic and slamming mailboxes harder than he had to because the deadness of these streets at such a non-hour, in such a non-season, could honestly kill you. "Are you happy with your life?" Gary said, waiting for a left-turn arrow. "Can you say you're ever happy?"
"Gary, I have an affliction.
A lot of people have afflictions. If that's your excuse, fine. If you want to feel sorry for yourself, fine. But why drag Mom down?"
"Well, you'll be leaving tomorrow."
"Meaning what?" Gary said. "That you'll sit in your chair and Mom will cook and clean for you?"
"There are things in life that simply have to be endured."
"Why bother staying alive if that's your attitude? What do you have to look forward to?"
"I ask myself that question every day."
"Well, and what's your answer?" Gary said. What's your answer? What do you think I should look forward to?
Travel.
I've traveled enough. I spent 30 years traveling. Time with family, time with people you love. No comment.
What do you mean, no comment?
Just that. No comment.
You're still sore about Christmas.
You may interpret it however you like.
If you're sore about Christmas, you might have the consideration to say so.
No comment.
Instead of insinuating.
We should have come 2 days later and left 2 days earlier, Alfred said.
That's all I have to say on the topic of Christmas. We should have stayed 48 hours.
It's because you're depressed, Dad. You are clinically depressed.
And so are you.
And the responsible thing would be to get some treatment. Did you hear me?
I said, so are you.
What are you talking about?
Figure it out.
Dad, really, no, what are you talking about? I'm not the one who sits in a chair all day and sleeps.
Underneath, you are,
Alfred pronounced.
That's simply false. One day you will see.
I will not, Gary said. My life is on a fundamentally different basis than yours.
Mark my words. I look at your marriage, I see what I see.
Someday you'll see it too.
That's empty talk and you know it. You're just pissed off with me and you have no way to deal with it.
I've told you I don't want to discuss this. And I have no respect for that.
Well, there are things in your life that I have no respect for either.
It shouldn't have hurt to hear that Alfred, who was wrong about almost everything, did not respect things in Gary's life. And yet it did hurt. At the hardware store, he let Alfred pay for the dimmer switch. The old man's careful plucking of bills from his slender wallet and his faint hesitation before he offered them were signs of his respect for a dollar, of his maddening belief that each one mattered. Back at the house, while Gary and Jonah kicked a soccer ball, Alfred gathered tools and killed the power to the kitchen and set about installing the dimmer. Even at this late date, it didn't occur to Gary not to let Alfred handle wiring. But when he came inside for lunch, he found that his father had done no more than remove the old switch plate. He was holding the dimmer switch like a detonator that made him shake with fear.
"My affliction makes this difficult," he explained. "You've got to sell this house," Gary said.
After lunch, he took his mother and his son to the St. Jude Museum of Transport. While Jonah climbed into old locomotives and toured the dry-docked submarine, and Enid sat and nursed her sore hip, Gary compiled a mental list of the museum's exhibits, hoping the list would give him a feeling of accomplishment. He couldn't deal with the exhibits themselves, their exhausting informativeness, their cheerful prose for the masses. The golden age of steam power, the dawn of flight, a century of automotive safety. Block after block of taxing text. What Gary hated most about the Midwest was how unpampered and unprivileged he felt in it. St. Jude, in its optimistic egalitarianism, consistently failed to accord him the respect to which his gifts and attainments entitled him.
Oh, the sadness of this place! The earnest St. Judean rubes all around him seemed curious and undepressed, happily filling their misshapen heads with facts, as if facts were going to save them. Not one woman half as pretty or as well-dressed as Caroline. Not one other man with a decent haircut or an abdomen as flat as Gary's. But, like Alfred, like Enid, they were all extremely deferential. They didn't jostle Gary or cut in front of him, but waited until he drifted to the next exhibit. Then they gathered round and read and learned. God, he hated the Midwest. He could hardly breathe or hold his head up. He thought he might be getting sick. He took refuge in the museum's gift shop and bought a silver belt buckle, two engravings of old Midland Pacific trestles, and a pewter hip flask, all for himself, a deerskin wallet for Aaron, and a CD-ROM Civil War game for Caleb.
Dad? Jonah said. Grandma says she'll buy me 2 books that cost less than $10 each, or 1 book for less than $20. Is that okay?
Enid and Jonah were a love fest. Enid had always preferred little kids to big kids, and Jonah's adaptive niche in the family ecosystem was to be the perfect grandchild, eager to scramble up on laps, unafraid of bitter vegetables, underexcited by television and computer games, and skilled at cheerfully answering questions like, "Are you loving school?" In St. Jude, he was luxuriating in the undivided attention of three adults. He declared St. Jude the nicest place he'd ever been. From the back seat of the old folksmobile, his elfin eyes wide, he marveled at everything Enid showed him.
"It's so easy to park here. No traffic. The Transport Museum is better than any museums we have, Dad, don't you agree? I love the legroom in this car. I think this is the nicest car I've ever ridden in. All the stores are so close and handy."
That night, after they'd returned from the museum, and Gary had gone out and done more shopping, Enid served stuffed pork chops and a chocolate birthday cake. Jonah was dreamily eating ice cream when she asked him if he might like to come and have Christmas in St. Jude.
"I would love that,"
Jonah said, his eyelids drooping with satiety.
"You could have sugar cookies and eggnog and help us decorate the tree," Enid said. "It'll probably snow, so you can go sledding. And, Jonah, there's a wonderful light show every year at Wayndale Park. It's called Christmas Land. They have the whole park lit up."
"Mother, it's March," Gary said.
"Can we come at Christmas?"
Jonah asked him. "We'll come again very soon," Gary said. "I don't know about Christmas."
"I think Jonah would love it," Enid said.
"I would completely love it," Jonah said, hoisting another spoonload of ice cream. "I think it might turn out to be the best Christmas I ever had."
"I think so, too," Enid said.
"It's March," Gary said. "We don't talk about Christmas in March, remember? We don't talk about it in June or August either, remember?" "Well," Alfred said, standing up from the table, "I am going to bed."
"St. Jude gets my vote for Christmas," Jonah said.
Enlisting Jonah directly in her campaign, exploiting a little boy for leverage, seemed to Gary a low trick on Enid's part. After he'd put Jonah to bed, he told his mother that Christmas ought to be the last of her worries. "Dad can't even install a light switch," he said. "And now you've got a leak upstairs. You've got water coming in around the chimney."
"I love this house,"
Enid said from the kitchen sink where she was scrubbing the pork chop pan.
"Dad just needs to work a little on his attitude."
"He needs shock treatments or medication," Gary said. "And if you want to dedicate your life to being his servant, that's your choice. If you want to live in an old house with a lot of problems and try to keep everything just the way you like it, that's fine, too. If you want to wear yourself out trying to do both, be my guest. Just don't ask me to make Christmas plans in March so you can feel okay about it all." Enid upended the pork chop pan on the counter beside the overloaded drainer. Gary knew he ought to pick up a towel, but the jumble of wet pans and platters and utensils from his birthday dinner made him weary. To dry them seemed a task as Sisyphean as to repair the things wrong with his parents' house. The only way to avoid despair was not to involve himself at all. He poured a smallish brandy nightcap while Enid, with unhappy, stabbing motions, scraped waterlogged food scraps from the bottom of the sink.
"What do you think I should do?" she said.
"Sell the house," Gary said. "Call a realtor tomorrow."
"And move into some cramped, modern condominium?"
Enid shook the repulsive wet scraps from her hand into the trash.
"When I have to go out for the day, Dave and Mary Beth invite Dad over for lunch. He loves that, and I feel so comfortable knowing he's with them. Last fall he was out planting a new yew, and he couldn't get the old stump out, and Joe Person came over with a pickaxe, and the two of them worked all afternoon together."
"He shouldn't be planting yews," Gary said, regretting already the smallness of his initial pour. "He shouldn't be using a pickaxe. The man can hardly stand up."
"Gary, I know we can't be here forever, but I want to have one last really nice family Christmas here, and I want—"
"Would you consider moving if we had that Christmas?" New hope sweetened Enid's expression.
"Would you and Caroline consider coming?"
"I can't make any promises," Gary said. "But if you'd feel more comfortable about putting the house on the market, we would certainly consider—"
"I would adore it if you came. Adore it."
"Mother, though,
You have to be realistic.
Let's get through this year, Enid said. Let's think about having Christmas here, like Jonah wants, and then we'll see.
Gary's anhedonia had worsened when he returned to Chestnut Hill. As a winter project, he'd been distilling hundreds of hours of home videos into a watchable 2-hour Greatest Lambert Hits compilation that he could make quality copies of and maybe send out as a video Christmas card. In the final edit, as he repeatedly reviewed his favorite family scenes and recued his favorite songs, Wild Horses, Time After Time, etc., he began to hate these scenes and hate these songs. And when, in the new darkroom, he turned his attention to the all-time Lambert 200, he found that he no longer enjoyed looking at still photographs either. For years he'd mentally tinkered with the all-time 200 as with an ideally balanced mutual fund, listing with great satisfaction the images that he was sure belonged in it. Now he wondered whom, besides himself, he was trying to impress with these pictures. Whom was he trying to persuade, and of what? He had a weird impulse to burn his old favorites. But his entire life was set up as a correction of his father's life, and he and Caroline had long agreed that Alfred was clinically depressed. And clinical depression was known to have genetic bases and to be substantially heritable. And so Gary had no choice but to keep resisting anhedonia, keep gritting his teeth, keep doing his best to have fun. He came awake with an itching hard-on, and Caroline beside him in the sheets. His nightstand light was still burning, but otherwise the room was dark. Caroline lay in sarcophagal posture, her back flat on the mattress and a pillow beneath her knees. Through the screens on the bedroom windows came seeping the coolish, humid air of a summer grown tired. No wind stirred the leaves of the sycamore whose lowest branches hung outside the windows. On Caroline's nightstand was a hardcover copy of Middle Ground, How to Spare Your Child the Adolescence You Had, Karen Tamkin, Ph.D., 1998. She seemed to be asleep. Her long arm, kept flabless by thrice-weekly swims at the cricket club, rested at her side. Gary gazed at her little nose, her wide red mouth, the blonde down and the dull sheen of sweat on her upper lip, the tapering strip of exposed blonde skin between the hem of her T-shirt and the elastic of her old Swarthmore College gym shorts. Her nearer breast pushed out against the inside of the T-shirt, the carmine definition of its nipple faintly visible through the fabric's stretched weave. When he reached out and smoothed her hair, her entire body jerked as if the hand were a defibrillator paddle. "What's going on here?" he said.
"My back is killing me."
"An hour ago you were laughing and feeling great. Now you're sore again?"
"The Motrin's wearing off."
The mysterious resurgence of the pain.
"You haven't said a sympathetic word since I hurt my back."
"Because you're lying about how you hurt it," Gary said.
"My God, again?"
"2 hours of soccer and horseplay in the rain. That's not the problem. It's the ringing phone."
"Yes," Caroline said, "because your mother won't spend 10 cents to leave a message. She has to let it ring 3 times and then hang up, ring 3 times and then hang up."
"It has nothing to do with anything you did," Gary said. "It's my mom. She magically flew here and kicked you in the back because she wants to hurt you."
"After listening to it ring and stop and ring and stop all afternoon, I'm a nervous wreck."
"Caroline, I saw you limping before you ran inside. I saw the look on your face. Don't tell me you weren't in pain already."
She shook her head. "You know what this is?"
"And then the eavesdropping. Do you know what this is? You're listening on the only other free phone in the house, and you have the gall to tell me,
Gary, you're depressed. Do you realize that?"
He laughed. "I don't think so."
"You're brooding and suspicious and obsessive. You walk around with a black look on your face. You don't sleep well. You don't seem to get pleasure out of anything."
"You're changing the subject," he said. "My mother called because she had a reasonable request regarding Christmas."
"Reasonable?" Now Caroline laughed. "Gary, she is bonkers on the topic of Christmas. She is a lunatic."
"Oh, Caroline, really?"
I mean it. Really, Caroline, they're going to be selling that house soon. They want us all to visit one more time before they die, Caroline, before my parents die.
We've always agreed about this. We agreed that five people with busy lives should not have to fly at the peak holiday season so that two people with nothing in their lives wouldn't have to come here. And I've been more than happy to have them.
The hell you have!
Until suddenly the rules change. You have not been happy to have them here, Caroline. They're at the point where they won't even stay for more than 48 hours.
And this is my fault?
She was directing her gestures and facial expressions somewhat eerily at the ceiling. What you don't understand, Gary, is that this is an emotionally healthy family. I am a loving and deeply involved mother. I have three intelligent, creative, and emotionally healthy children. If you think there's a problem in this house, you better take a look at yourself.
I'm making a reasonable proposal, Gary said, and you're calling me depressed.
So it's never occurred to you?
The minute I bring up Christmas, I'm depressed.
Seriously, are you telling me it's never occurred to you in the last 6 months that you might have a clinical problem?
It is extremely hostile, Caroline, to call another person crazy.
Not if the person potentially has a clinical problem.
I'm proposing that we go to St. Jude, he said. If you won't talk about it like an adult, I'll make my own decision.
Oh, yeah? Caroline made a contemptuous noise. I guess Jonah might go with you, but see if you can get Aaron and Caleb on the plane with you. Just ask them where they'd rather be for Christmas.
Just ask them whose team they're on.
I was under the impression that we're a family, Gary said, and that we do things together.
You're the one deciding unilaterally.
Tell me this is not a marriage-ending problem.
You're the one who's changed.
Because no, Caroline, that is ridiculous. There are good reasons to make a one-time exception this year.
You're depressed, she said, and I want you back. I'm tired of living with a depressed old man.
Gary, for his part, wanted back the Caroline who just a few nights ago had clutched him in bed when there was heavy thunder. The Caroline who came skipping toward him when he walked into a room. The semi-orphaned girl whose most fervent wish was to be on his team. But he'd also always loved how tough she was, how unlike a Lambert, how fundamentally unsympathetic to his family. Over the years he'd collected certain remarks of hers into a kind of personal decalogue, an all-time Caroline 10 to which he privately referred for strength and sustenance. 1, you're nothing at all like your father. 2, you don't have to apologize for buying the BMW. 3, your dad emotionally abuses your mom. 4, I love the taste of your cum. 5, work was the drug that ruined your father's life. 6, let's buy both. 7, your family has a diseased relationship with food. 8, you're an incredibly good-looking man. 9, Denise is jealous of what you have. 10, there's absolutely nothing useful about suffering. He'd subscribed to this credo for years and years, had felt deeply indebted to Caroline for each remark. And now he wondered how much of it was true. Maybe none of it.
I'm calling the travel agent tomorrow morning, he said.
And I'm telling you, Caroline replied immediately, call Dr. Pierce instead. You need to talk to somebody.
I need somebody who tells the truth.
You want the truth? You want me to tell you why I'm not going?
Caroline sat up and leaned forward at the funny angle that her backache dictated.
You really want to know?
Gary's eyes fell shut. The crickets outside sounded like water running interminably in pipes. From the distance came a rhythmic canine barking like the downthrusts of a handsaw.
The truth, Caroline said, is that 48 hours sounds just about right to me. I don't want my children looking back on Christmas as the time when everybody screamed at each other, which basically seems to be unavoidable now. Your mother walks in the door with 360 days worth of Christmas mania she's been obsessing since the previous January. And then, of course, where's that Austrian reindeer figurine? Don't you like it? Don't you use it? Where is it? Where is it? Where is the Austrian reindeer figurine? She's got her food obsessions, her money obsessions, her clothes obsessions. She's got the whole 10-piece set of baggage, which my husband used to agree is kind of a problem. But now, suddenly, out of the blue, he's taking her side.
We're going to turn the house inside out, looking for a piece of $13 gift store kitsch, because it has sentimental value to your mother, Caroline. And when it turns out that Caleb...
This is not an honest version.
Please, Gary, let me finish. When it turns out that Caleb did the kind of thing that any normal boy might do to a piece of gift store crap that he found in the basement...
I can't listen to this.
No, no, the problem is not that your eagle-eyed mother is obsessed with some garbagey piece of Austrian kitsch. No, that's not the problem.
It was $100 hand-carved.
I don't care if it's $1,000. Since when do you punish him, your own son, for your mother's craziness? It's like you're suddenly trying to make us act like it's 1964, and we're all living in Peoria. Clean your plate, wear a necktie, no TV tonight, and you wonder why we're fighting? You wonder why Aaron rolls his eyes when your mom walks in the room? It's like you're embarrassed to let her see us. It's like for as long as she's here, you're trying to pretend we live somewhere that she approves of. But I'm telling you, Gary, we have nothing to be ashamed of. Your mother's the one who should be embarrassed. She follows me around the kitchen, scrutinizing me like as if I roast a turkey every week, and if I turn my back for 1 second, she's going to pour a quart of oil into whatever I'm making. And as soon as I leave the room, she's going to root through the trash like some fucking food police. She's going to take food from the trash and feed it to my children.
The potato was in the sink, not the trash, Caroline.
And you defend her. She goes outside to the trash barrels to see what other dirt she can dig up and disapprove of, and she's asking me, literally every 10 minutes, how's your back? How's your back? How's your back? Is your back any better? How'd you hurt it? Is your back any better? How's your back? She goes looking for things to disapprove of, and then she tries to tell my children how to dress for dinner in my house, and you don't back me up. You don't back me up, Gary. You start apologizing, and I don't get it, but I'm not doing it again. Basically, I think your brother's got the right idea. Here's a sweet, smart, funny man who's honest enough to say what he can and can't tolerate in the way of get-togethers, and your mother acts like he's this huge embarrassment and failure. Well, you wanted the truth. The truth is, I cannot stand another Christmas like that. If we absolutely have to see your parents, we're doing it on our own turf, just like you promised we always would.
A pillow of blue blackness lay on Gary's brain. He'd reached the point on the post-martini evening downslope where a sense of complication weighed on his cheeks, his forehead, his eyelids, his mouth. He understood how much his mother infuriated Caroline, and at the same time, he found fault with almost everything that Caroline had said. The rather beautiful wooden reindeer, for example, had been stored in a well-marked box. Caleb had broken two of its legs and hammered a roofing nail through its skull. Enid had taken an uneaten baked potato from the sink and sliced it and fried it for Jonah. And Caroline hadn't bothered to wait until her in-laws had left town before depositing in a trash barrel the pink polyester bathrobe that Enid had given her for Christmas. "When I said I wanted the truth," he said, not opening his eyes, "I meant I saw you limping before you ran inside."
"Oh, my God," Caroline said.
"My mother didn't hurt your back. You hurt your back."
"Please, Gary, do me a favor and call Dr. Pierce.
Admit that you're lying. And I'll talk about anything you want, but nothing's going to change until you admit that."
"I don't even recognize your voice."
"5 days in St. Jude. You can't do that for a woman who, like you say, has nothing else in her life.
Please, come back to me."
A jolt of rage forced Gary's eyes open. He kicked the sheet aside and jumped out of bed.
"This is a marriage ender. I can't believe it.
Gary, please,
we're going to split up over a trip to St. Jude."
And then a visionary in a warm-up jacket was lecturing to pretty college students. Behind the visionary, in a pixelated middle distance, were sterilizers and chromatography cartridges and tissue stains and weak solution, long-necked medico-scientific faucets, pin-ups of spread-eagled chromosomes, and diagrams of tuna-red brains sliced up like sashimi. The visionary was Earl Curly Eberly, a small-mouthed 50-year-old in dime-store glasses whom the creators of the Exxon Corporation's promotional video had done their best to make glamorous. The camera work was nervous. The lab floor pitched and lurched. Blurry zooms zeroed in on female student faces aglow with fascination. Curiously obsessive attention was paid to the back of the visionary head. It was indeed purely.
"Of course, chemistry, too, even brain chemistry," Eberle was saying, "is basically just manipulation of electrons in their shells. But compare this, if you will, to an electronics that consists of little 2- and 3-pole switches. The diode, the transistor, the brain, by contrast, has several dozen kinds of switches. The neuron either fires or it doesn't, but this decision is regulated by receptor sites that often have shades of offness and onness between plane off and plane on. Even if you could build an artificial neuron out of molecular transistors, the conventional wisdom is that you can still never translate all that chemistry into the language of yes, no, without running out of space. If we conservatively estimate 20 neuroactive ligands, of which as many as 8 can operate simultaneously, and each of these 8 switches has 5 different settings, not to bore you with the combinatorics, but unless you're living in a world of Mr. Potato Heads, you're going to be a pretty funny-looking android.
Close-up of a turnip-headed male student laughing.
"Now, these are facts so basic," Eberle said, "that we ordinarily wouldn't even bother spelling them out. It's just the way things are. The only workable connection we have with the electrophysiology of cognition and volition is chemical. That's the received wisdom, part of the gospel of our science. Nobody in their right mind would try to connect the world of neurons with the world of printed circuits."
Eberle paused dramatically.
"Nobody, that is, but the Axon Corporation."
Ripples of buzz crossed the sea of institutional investors who'd come to Ballroom B of the Four Seasons Hotel in central Philadelphia for the roadshow promoting Axon's initial public offering. A giant video screen had been set up on the dais. On each of the 20 round tables in the semi-dark ballroom were platters of satay and sushi appetizers with the appropriate dipping sauces. Gary was sitting with his sister, Denise, at a table near the door. He had hopes of transacting business at this roadshow, and he would rather have come alone. But Denise had insisted on having lunch, today being Monday and Monday being her one day off, and had invited herself along. Gary had figured that she would find political or moral or aesthetic reasons to deplore the proceedings, and, sure enough, she was watching the video with her eyes narrowed in suspicion and her arms crossed tightly. She was wearing a yellow shift with a red floral print, black sandals, and a pair of Trotsky-ish round plastic glasses. But what really set her apart from the other women in Ballroom B was the bareness of her legs. Nobody who dealt in money did not wear stockings. What is the Correctol process?
"Correctol," said the cut-out image of Curly Eberle, whose young audience had been digitally pureed into a uniform backdrop of tuna-red brain matter, "is a revolutionary neurobiological therapy."
Eberle was seated on an ergonomic desk chair in which, it now developed, he could float and swerve vertiginously through a graphical space representing the inner sea world of the intracranium. Kelpie ganglia and squid-like neurons and eel-like capillaries began to flash by. Originally conceived as a therapy for sufferers of PD and AD and other degenerative neurological diseases, Eberle said, "Correctol has proved so powerful and versatile that its promise extends not only to therapy but to an outright cure, and to a cure not only of these terrible degenerative afflictions, but also of a host of ailments typically considered psychiatric or even psychological. Simply put, Correctol offers, for the first time, the possibility of renewing and improving the hardwiring of an adult human brain."
"Ew," Denise said, wrinkling her nose.
Gary by now was quite familiar with the Correctol process. He'd scrutinized Axon's red herring prospectus and read every analysis of the company he could find on the Internet and through the private services that Centrust subscribed to. Bearish analysts, mindful of recent gut-wrenching corrections in the biotech sector, were cautioning against investing in an untested medical technology that was at least 6 years from market. Certainly, a bank like Centrust, with its fiduciary duty to be conservative, wasn't going to touch this IPO. But Axon's fundamentals were a lot healthier than those of most biotech startups,
and to Gary, the fact that the company had bothered to buy his father's patent at such an early stage in Correctol's development was a sign of great corporate confidence. He saw an opportunity here to make some money and avenge Exxon's screwing of his father and, more generally, be bold where Alfred had been timid. It happened that in June, as the first dominoes of the overseas currency crises were toppling, Gary had pulled most of his playing-around money out of Euro and Far Eastern growth funds. This money was available now for investment in Exxon. And since the IPO was still 3 months away, and since the big sales push for it had not begun, and since the red herring contained such dubieties as give non-insiders pause, Gary should have had no trouble getting a commitment for 5,000 shares. But trouble was pretty much all he'd had. His own discount broker, who had barely heard of Exxon, belatedly did his homework and called Gary back with the news that his firm's allocation was a token 2,500 shares. Normally, a brokerage wouldn't commit more than 5% of its allocation to a single customer this early in the game. But since Gary had been the first to call, his man was willing to set aside 500 shares. Gary pushed for more, but the sad fact was that he was not a big-time customer. He typically invested in multiples of 100, and to save on commissions, he executed smaller trades himself online. Now, Caroline was a big investor. With Gary's guidance, she often bought in multiples of 1,000. Her broker worked for the largest house in Philadelphia, and there was no doubt that 4,500 shares of Exxon's new issue could be found for a truly valued customer. This was how the game was played. Unfortunately, since the Sunday afternoon when she'd hurt her back, Gary and Caroline had been as close to not speaking as a couple could be and still function as parents. Gary was keen to get his full 5,000 shares of Exxon, but he refused to sacrifice his principles and crawl back to his wife and beg her to invest for him. So, instead, he'd phoned his large-cap contact at Heavy and Hodap, a man named Pudge Portley, and asked to be put down for 5,000 shares of the offering on his own account. Over the years, in his fiduciary role at SunTrust, Gary had bought a lot of stock from Portley, including some certifiable turkeys. Gary hinted now to Portley that SunTrust might give him an even larger portion of its business in the future. But Portley, with weird hedginess, had agreed only to pass along Gary's request to Daffy Anderson, who was Heavy and Hodap's deal manager for the IPO. There had then ensued 2 maddening weeks during which Pudge Portley failed to call Gary back and confirm an allocation. Online buzz about Exxon was building from a whisper to a roar. 2 related major papers by Earl Eberle's team, Reverse Tomographic Stimulation of Synaptogenesis in Selected Neural Pathways and Transitory Positive Reinforcement in Dopamine-Deprived Limbic Circuits, Recent Clinical Progress, appeared in Nature and the New England Journal of Medicine within days of each other. The 2 papers received heavy coverage in the financial press, including a front-page notice in the Wall Street Journal. Analyst after analyst began to flash strong buys for Exxon, and still Portley did not return Gary's messages, and Gary could feel the advantages of his insiderly head start disappearing hour by hour. 1. Have a cocktail. Of ferrocitrates and ferroacetates, specially formulated to cross the blood-brain barrier and accumulate interstitially, said the unseen pitchman, whose voice had joined Earl Eberle's on the video soundtrack. We also stir in a mild, non-habit-forming sedative and a generous squirt of hazelnut mochaccino syrup, courtesy of the country's most popular chain of coffee bars. A female extra from the earlier lecture scene, a girl with whose neurological functions there was clearly nothing in the slightest wrong, drank with great relish and sexily pulsing throat muscles a tall, frosty glass of Correctol electrolytes. "What was Dad's patent?" Denise whispered to Gary. "Ferroacetate gel something-something?" Gary nodded grimly. "Electropolymerization."
from his correspondence files at home, which contained, among other things, every letter he'd ever received from either of his parents, Gary had dug out an old copy of Alfred's patent. He wasn't sure he'd ever really looked at it. So impressed was he now by the old man's clear account of electrical anisotropy in certain ferro-organic gels, and his proposal that these gels be used to minutely image living human tissues and create direct electrical contact with fine morphologic structures. Comparing the wording of the patent with the description of Correctol at Axon's newly renovated website, Gary was struck by the depth of similarity. Evidently, Alfred's $5,000 process was at the center of a process for which Axon now hoped to raise upward of $200 million. As if a man didn't have enough in his life to lie awake at night and fume about.
"Yo, Kelsey, yeah, Kelsey, give me 12,000 Exxon at 104 max, the young man sitting to Gary's left said suddenly and too loudly.
The kid had a palm-top stock quoter, a wire in his ear, and the schizophrenic eyes of the cellularly occupied.
12,000 Exxon, upper limit 104, he said.
Exxon. Axon. Better be careful, Gary thought. 2. Put on a headset and turn on the radio.
"You won't hear a thing, not unless your dental fillings pick up ball games on the AM dial," the pitchman joked as the smiling girl lowered onto her camera-friendly head a metal dome reminiscent of a hairdryer. "But radio waves are penetrating the innermost recesses of your skull. Imagine a kind of global positioning system for the brain, RF radiation pinpointing and selectively stimulating the neural pathways associated with particular skills, like signing your name, climbing stairs, remembering your anniversary, thinking positively, clinically tested at scores of hospitals across America, Dr. Eberle's reverse tomographic methods have now been further refined to make this stage of the Correctol process as simple and painless as a visit to your hairstylist.
Until recently, Eberle broke in, he in his chair still drifting through a sea of simulated blood and gray matter, my process required overnight hospitalization and the physical screwing of a calibrated steel ring into the patient's cranium. Many patients found this inconvenient. Some also experienced discomfort. Now, however, enormous increases in computing power have made possible a process that is instantaneously self-correcting as to the location of the individual neural pathways under stimulation.
Kelsey, you demand.